myself without the coffee and cigarettes. And it tastes like loneliness with sugar spilling out your mouth. The sweeter it up till it tastes like love. But you can't get the poison out, yeah.
Welcome to Unlearning Childhood, where we discuss the things in our childhood that we have grown and learned about and changed. I'm Joshua Turpin.
And I'm Abigail Williams.
And today we'll be talking about the history of the Bible.
I'm very excited for this one because this is not my area of expertise. This is Josh's area. And so I'm very excited to learn because I know there's so much that I don't know.
Yes. For us growing up, part of the Bible was a discussion about inerrancy and trusting the Bible above any other resources, which is rooted in certain things that we'll talk about. But that's more about interpretation of the Bible than history of the Bible. And so that's its own conversation, but I'll try to touch upon it a little bit. This is, I guess, how we're gonna, this is how I dealt with it and what I have learned that has helped me deal with these conversations and about what the Bible has become.
Yeah, I'm so excited because my history of the Bible was like, well, the Bible is written, the Bible is true because it says it's true, and it's not circular reasoning because it's the Bible.
Yeah. So I want to start out with that specific text, actually. The text that people use to talk about the Bible being inerrant and inspired by God.
The Timothy one, right?
Yes, it is 2 Timothy 3:16-17. And it says, all scripture in English. All scripture is inspired by God and is useful for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, so that everyone who belongs to God may be proficient, equipped for every good work. And this is from the New Revised Standard Version. Currently, I'm reading a book by Angela N. Parker, who is a womanist New Testament scholar.
Can we define womanist real fast?
Womanist is a person writing, a Black woman writing from her perspective. I should probably read through Alice Walker's fourfold definition of that for like the full idea, but it's drawing upon their experiences. It started out as we currently know it. There's Alice Walker's version, who is sort of the founder and the person who coined it as it is in the United States. There are two other non-United States versions. But it sort of shifted and changed away from her original ideas, which is just what happens. She coined the term and the idea in the early 70s, but it is contemporary as I study it. It started out with three people: Dolores Williams, Jacqueline Grant,
Katie Geneva Cannon,
and they were studying Black liberation theology. And they found out that Black liberation theology and the civil rights movement in general tended to neglect women and put women's needs and confronting sexism toward the back.
Gotcha.
And to the point where, like, there's this report released in the 60s called the Moynihan Report, and it essentially blamed, in large part, not totally, Black women for the failings of the Black community and the failings of Black culture, using data. And some other people, it's since been critiqued. And really, it's been demonstrated that it was not Black women, but rather the level of poverty that was prevalent among the Black community. And you do this by showing that, like, actually these same problems that you're blaming this are the same for white families and for rural families.
So as if capitalism is bad?
Yeah, I'd say so. At least as long as it requires a workforce that gets paid less than others.
Yeah, imagine. I thought everything was supposed to trickle down.
Yeah, well, I think Reaganomics has been largely shoved aside except when useful.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's sort of womanism is drawing from Black women's experience and challenging the ways that so they move from Black liberation theology and they combine and then they turn to feminism, but feminism has a history of just ignoring race. Putting it to the back. So they change, so it's sort of this thing, and they're trying to connect to the Black community and the Black churches while also trying to be academics. Some people reject academia and just go straight for the churches, but it's very complicated, it's very subjective, and it's partially rooted in Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza's discussion of feminist interpretations of the Bible, which is, do not pretend to that you can read the Bible objectively, because we're all controlled, all of our perspectives are rooted in our current society. And so whenever you say I'm doing anything objectively, it's only because you have certain ideas that you're coming
absolutely. Like even in science, like we have, you know, oh, this is, you know, we're doing things objectively, but that's just based on what we know and what we've been able to demonstrate, because there was a time where objectively the sun revolved around the earth. Yeah. Because that's what we knew, and that's what where the science was at the time. And so people were like, no, actually, it's not that. And they're just like, no, you're wrong.
Right. And I should also clarify, I said partially rooted in Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza's. While that is true, womanism is its own thing. And it was actually sort of coming up around the same time as Schussler Fiorenza's thing. Mm-hmm. But it shares a lot of the same ideas, and Schussler Fiorenza was actually building off of a lot of Black feminist work as well. Like she quotes like Audre Lorde and bell hooks in her like really first original stuff. And so this is sort of coming up together, but womanism is a much smaller group because only Black women can do it.
Yeah. And that's why you're womanist adjacent.
Womanist aligned. In solidarity with womanists, co-conspirator. That's a friend
womanist of mine. Partner in crime.
Yeah. Or
accomplice. Womanist accomplice.
Yeah. Hoping to be. So anyway.
Aspiring womanist accomplice.
So Angela N. Parker, in a book that was released this year, called If God Still Breathes, Why Can't I? Where she is analyzing parts of the New Testament in light of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, especially, I mean, like that, if it was published this year, like you think, why can't I breathe? George Floyd right there, I can't breathe. Like, a powerful title right there. Right.
So whenever you say all scripture is God breathed, if God can breathe, why can't I?
Oh, damn.
Right? Because God is supposed to suffer alongside us.
Yeah.
In which case, for people who are being oppressed, is God suffering beside them? If God
can breathe. If God can breathe, why can't I?
So it's a very good title. Her translation, which is definitely my favorite of the Second Timothy passage, is all writings are God-breathed and advantageous toward teaching, toward rebuke, toward correcting faults, toward instruction in justice, so that the person of God may be capable of finishing all good works. Very good.
Yeah.
So
it's more like, it's not like the Bible's true because it says it is and because God did it. It's more like, this is like it kind of sounds like it's more of like a guide. Like this is, you know, we can use this to do good stuff.
Yes.
But it's not saying this is, you know, like an inerrant scripture, something that never changes. It's like, this is a tool we have that we can use to do good things. But in the end, it's a tool and not like a sacred altar.
Yes.
Thing.
Also, I want to point out that in neither translation does the Bible say all. First of all, the Bible, the word for scripture there is grapho, which is just writing. Scripture is something that we put on the text. We think this is what Paul meant, but we don't know. We're putting that on the text.
So we don't know, but we're just making the assumption. But because they don't specifically say that they played instruments, in the early churches that way. We can't because
right. Well, this is the
Church of Christ. It's yeah. like opposite. It's just like yeah. sometimes we're allowed to make assumptions and sometimes we're not.
Right. This is what you might call in my field poiesis or poiesis. I don't know how it's pronounced. It's the art of words. This is where we get like poet and poem.
Yeah.
And so all translation is interpretation because there is no such thing as in any language, a one-to-one translation. There are multiple possible translations that don't actually get across the original idea of that word.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's just part of the problem, which is part of what we're going to talk about.
It's like a butt dial isn't the same thing as a booty call.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you were translating that, how do you, that's, it sounded
yeah, like one, that. If you translate it, one is very different than the other.
Yeah. Also, at no point in this text does it say the Bible is useful for science or the Bible is 100% correct. It says it is useful for teaching, for reproof, for justice.
Yeah.
So it's even this text that is often used to quote the inerrancy of the Bible because it is God-breathed. The actual word there is theopneustos or theopneustos, which is just literally God-breathed. Thea meaning God, pneustos from pneuma meaning wind or breath. So or also spirit. So it's God-spirited. That doesn't... It's God-breathed can mean anything. It's a very weird thing. The second thing I wanted to read is, I know I didn't ask you to pull this up ahead of time.
Okay.
Do you mind pulling up on Bible Gateway or Bible Hub or any other online Bible? Genesis 6:3.
6:3. Okay. So according what version do we want?
I always say NRSV because it's the scholarly standard.
Scholarly standard. My school standard was the NIV and then the ESV.
Yeah.
But according to the NRSV on BibleGateway.com, Genesis 6:3, then the Lord said, my spirit... Oh, not yet. I'll wait. Okay.
I will read you. I'm asking you and whoever is listening to this to look it up.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I want you to hear this as I read from a translated version of a Dead Sea Scroll. This was written, I don't know, probably before Jesus was born. And you hear conversations about the Dead Sea Scrolls, if you go to church, how accurate they were and how close they were to the text we have now.
Yeah, and the Dead Sea Scrolls are like what we use to translate things on, and they were sealed in big pots by the people of Qumran, by yes. the Dead Sea, and then like some little shepherd kid was like playing and like kicked a rock and he broke a pot and then he found the Dead Sea Scrolls and then like Hobby Lobby stole them or something.
I mean, Hobby Lobby's thing's a whole different thing. And a lot of those turned out to be fake.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But Hobby Lobby did technically not fill out the correct paperwork or get permission from the government where they took it from. So like...
They stole it.
Yeah. And they had to pay a lot of money for that and return it. They've returned, I think, more than 10,000 documents or artifacts.
Good for them.
So anyway, I'm going to read to you from the Dead Sea Scroll. This is 4Q, which means 4th cave, Qumran K4, which is where most of the stuff is found.
Okay.
252, which is some other way of defining it. Fragment 1.
Okay.
And some of this is going to be a bit weird, but I'll read this. In the 480th year of the life of Noah came their end. And God said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, and their days shall be determined to be 120 years until the end of the flood. And the waters of the flood arrived on the earth in the 600th year of the life of Noah in the second month, on the first day of the week, on the 17th of the month. On that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights.
Is that all just one verse?
I mean, they don't actually say verses. This is just connections, you know?
Well,
Oh, did it happen to jump over to 7:11 through 12 while I was reading?
I can't find that part yet. Hang on, I haven't even found where it starts talking about, like, chapter 7?
Yeah.
I gotta click to chapter 7.
Oh, what? 7. Really? That's weird.
Okay, yeah, it's chapter 7, verse 11. Yeah.
Okay, now I'm going to keep reading.
Okay.
Until the 26th day of the third month, the fifth day of the week, and the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Is that still good?
The waters on the earth 150 days is the very last verse of chapter 7.
Okay.
I can't find the other parts about that. Now I'm going to go to chapter 8 because I feel like you're going to be there next.
Until the 14th day of the seventh month, the third day of the week, and at the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. 2 days, the fourth and the fifth day, and on the sixth day, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Hurarat or Turarat or Ararat.
Ararat.
The Ararat is a Greek term. Okay. On the 17th day of the seventh month, and the waters continued to abate until the 10th month, the first day of the month, the fourth day of the week, and the tops of the mountaintops appeared. Now, was that 100?
All in chapter 8.
Yeah.
Why are we skipping so much? Is that like just a fragment or is that one like continuous sentence?
That's not one continuous sentence.
Are we like skipping from fragment 1 to fragment 3?
No, this is still fragment 1.
It's still fragment 1? Is there gaps between?
There are a few gaps.
But not chapter-sized gaps?
No, I'm reading from the English translation. I don't have the actual document in front of me. But also, were all of those words correct? Like, were there any additional words? Were there any missing words?
It depends on, like, according to this translation, it wasn't the same.
No, that's the point, is that translation is based on a different document.
Oh.
So there are different...
It's based on a different document from that...
It's not from
Qumran. Dead Sea Scroll?
It's not
based on the Dead Sea Scroll.
Not based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Most translations are not from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Those are just... actually, the NRSV, I think it was translated in the 80s, so the Dead Sea Scrolls weren't like even completely documented and shared yet.
So then why are we even talking about the Dead Sea Scroll? Because that one's like the Dead Sea Scrolls proves that the Bible is 100%. You know, it's the same. Yeah. It's always been the same. But if we're not even using the Dead Sea Scrolls.
But also, it's not the same.
Now we're not using Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, well, I don't even mean that. I mean, like, as you were reading the Bible alongside it, they were jumping. You were jumping around.
Yeah.
And there were additional words.
We skipped all over the Nephilim.
Yeah.
We skipped that and we skipped a bunch of stuff. And then we had different, I think the numbers were about the same, but I couldn't find the 5 days and the 2 days. No.
So this is the point.
Didn't have like the 2 days and the 5 days.
Yeah. So this is the point, which is whenever you hear people say that the Dead Sea Scrolls were super accurate to what we have now, that is wrong.
Yeah, because what we have now isn't based off the Dead Sea Scrolls, apparently.
Right. It's not.
The way they told us about this in Sunday school and in Bible classes implied that it was our translations were, you know, based off of the most up-to-date, recent, and accurate information.
It is.
So it was like the new, it is?
Yeah.
Is that like when why they like do new NIV translations?
That's part of the reason.
Like, okay. I know that people didn't like that one because it was more gender inclusive or something.
Yes. And actually there's a whole.
Was that why we did it? Was it really because it was more gender inclusive that people didn't like it?
So what happened with the NIV is I think it was like the 2014 version.
Yeah, it was the 2014 version because it was the 19.
Yeah.
Or was it 2012?
Okay.
It was 2012.
Got it. They prepared to publish it earlier with certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And Lifeway Bookstores and Mardell both said, if you publish it like this, we will not sell your book. And so the people who did the NIV had to go through and change how they translated it so that they could sell copies.
What did they translate so terribly that the Christian bookstores didn't like?
Well, it's because it was more inclusive. And there were some things that they translated better than is traditionally translated.
Because so they did it better and they're like, oh, this is too good. You gotta...
No, it's because it didn't agree with their theology.
Jesus Christ.
Right?
And, really? And so I heard that it was because it was what I heard in high school.
Mm-hmm.
When I was like a sophomore, was that we had to switch from the NIV to the ESV because they no longer sold the 1984 NIVs. Mm-hmm. And the 2012 NIVs weren't translated right the way they translated. They were like, whoa, they added like sons and daughters of God when it mm-hmm. just said sons of God. And so they're adding things into the scripture, which is a sin. Also, something about the bags of gold and talents.
Yeah. So the reason that they do sons and daughters is because, as we discussed, translation is not a one-to-one thing. And if you look at any good Bible in English, they explain their decisions for these things for you,
yeah.
and they explain their source texts, text that they're pulling from.
Yeah, the weird footnotes.
Well, not
like,
even
this
the footnotes.
This could be a hippopotamus. It's
just in the front, like the very front.
I never read the front.
Exactly.
I never read the front.
And that's sort of what we're going to talk about, is this the NIV, your ESV, your CEB, the NRSV. The New King James Version, all of these tell you certain information up front. And so what the NIV people did is following what the NRSV people did as the scholarly standard, said, okay, whenever we read the Bible and we translate it in Hebrew and in Greek, but I'm going to stick with the Hebrew for this explanation,
mm-hmm.
You have masculine and feminine genders. There is not neuter. It is always masculine or feminine. So mm-hmm. in whenever you're reading the Ten Commandments and it says you shall not kill, it is you masculine, right? And so we translate that as you because in English it's just you.
Yeah.
And they cannot escape, like, just the way that Hebrew is structured. A biblical Hebrew is structured.
So if we translate the Bible correctly, it would mean that you men shall not kill.
And women can.
Right?
This is already happening. This happened in the King James Version in 1611. But you get this, you have sons and daughters and men and women because we are translating it as, so this word isn't just applying to the masculine plural. It is applying to everyone who is considered underneath the masculine plural. And so we just say it. We say the thing out loud.
Why can't we just do like children of God? Because then that covers, you know, it covers people, you know, who are like assigned male at birth, people assigned female at birth. It, mm-hmm. you know, it covers people, you know, it's not just men and women. You know, it also covers, you know, like all of our... But non-binary people or mm-hmm. trans people. It's just, I feel like you could be more inclusive while being less controversial by going children of God.
Yeah.
Why is that so hard?
So that's how I translate it. But also there are some times whenever you have to ask, is this text specifically talking about only men?
I'm sure the circumcision texts are talking about only men.
Right, for sure. And so... I translate like you, M for masculine, mm-hmm. or they, M for masculine specifically, or I just say the men instead of they.
You assigned male at birth person.
Yes. And so that's part of the complication of translation. And that's just like the basic stuff that you can read about this stuff in the front of your Bible and why they're making the decisions. They aren't hiding these decisions from you. You just aren't reading them.
Because no one reads the preface.
Right.
Because it's just the boring stuff.
Right. But it's super important, right?
How come I didn't read the preface, but somehow I read through like the entire book of like Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy because I had to, and it's just like, you shall cut the fat around the kidneys and the fat mm-hmm. around this, and it's just like,
yeah. Right. So it is, but you know, it's very important to know your Bible, and that's just one aspect of the translation part. That's not even our main focus. It's just very important to know this information up front. And turning back to the Dead Sea Scrolls, we'll get to this a little bit deeper later, but whenever we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you have some texts that are, we call them proto, which just means like earlier, before. So there's proto-Masoretic, and Masoretic is what our Hebrew Bible text is based off of.
Masoretic or Nazar?
Masoretic with an M.
Nazareth. Mazar.
Yeah. Like mom.
Mom, Masoretic.
Yeah. And okay. It's because the Masoretes translated it, or not the translated Masoretes? It. The Masoretes. T. Masoretes.
Okay. Oh, Masoretes.
Yeah.
Maserati. That's what Google gave me. It sounded a bit like Nazarene, and I was right. Like,
so,
okay.
So our Hebrew Bible is what they were the people who copied it and like kept it very solid. So in Qumran, we have proto-Masoretic texts, which means we think that the Masoretic text came from this. We also have proto-Septuagint texts.
That's Septuagint is, that's the Greek one?
The Greek version, yes.
And the Vulgate is the Latin one.
Yes. The Latin one is a translation, and so that's going to be a side conversation later. We also have, in Qumran, the Proto-Samaritan Pentateuch, and the Samaritan Pentateuch is a different version of the Torah, of the first five books.
From the Samaritans?
From the Samaritans, who are, there are still Samaritan Jews alive.
But no one, so like the Samaritans, like the people that no one liked, Samaritans, like, you know, people go around.
The Jews didn't and like
the good Samaritan. The Jews right. didn't like him. Yeah, that's why I said no one liked him, because growing up with the Judeo-Christian aspect, it's just like, oh, we don't like the Samaritans. Right. They do things different. But then we right. have the good Samaritan, who is your token diversity yeah. person.
So the Samaritan Pentateuch, the reason that there was conflict is the Samaritan Pentateuch, and I say Pentateuch because it is in Greek, as far as we know, has a different place. Their actual text has a different place listed for where the temple should be and where all the good things took place than the Jewish text.
Yeah, it was on a mountain, right?
Yeah, so the Jews have on Zion and in Jerusalem, and the Samaritans have a different thing. And both versions of this text exist in Qumran side by side.
Hmm.
And then we also have some other, like the proto Talmudic text, I believe this is proto Targum. I think it's Talmud. I'll get to it later. I have my notes. But like, so all four of these different versions of texts are found at Qumran. And so we, along with other documents where they were like criticizing the Jerusalem priesthood and like setting up their own rules and that sort of thing. So we know that at minimum from around 150 BCE, that at least one Jewish community was okay with having all of these different versions and copying all these different versions. So now that we have that, this is all introduction stuff. Now I'm going to turn to like the actual history of the Bible.
I already feel like we've already talked about so much.
Yeah, it's a lot. Welcome.
All new material for me. Like I knew little bits and pieces from like, I only knew about Qumran because of like this Advent book thing that my mom would read called like Jotham's Journey.
Mine too.
Yeah, I think we probably learned about it from the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. So now I'm going to talk about the history of the development of the Hebrew Bible. Hebrew Bible's my focus, so I'm only going to spend a little bit of time on the Christian Testament because, you know, it's not my field of study, and that is much more complicated.
And like we talked in the last episode, the Christian Testament is what has been commonly called the New Testament?
Yes. Okay. Because the language of New Testament, as it is in English, is rooted in
supremacy, because new is better. Yeah,
it is rooted in anti-Semitism. It wasn't always called the New Testament, but it is now.
Okay. And we call it the Christian Testament.
Right, the Christian Testament. So I'm just gonna use some terms. These are general ideas. There's text critical or text criticism, form criticism, redaction criticism, and historical criticism. All of these are very important, and what Bible study was basically rooted around, especially the Christian Testament, until like really 50 years ago. Starting with the Enlightenment in like the 1700s, I think it was. Let's just say from like the 1700s to the 1960s. This is what most New Testament stuff was based around. So text criticism is looking at the text, seeing how it's different, different versions, because people knew that they were like, we have thousands of different documents that disagree with each other about the Christian Testament.
The reason this is, I'm sorry, this is completely off topic, is the reason the Gideons don't do the, they only do like Psalms and Proverbs, is that because of how like, what you're just talking about?
No.
Okay. Are they the ones who do that?
They are the people who do that.
Okay.
Yeah. Historical criticism is just, you know, sort of like understanding the ancient world, understanding the history to try to get at the quote unquote objective meaning of the text. There is some very good work in this. I actually enjoy reading it because you're just like delving into like, was Mark originally oral, people sharing it? Or was it, this is all like text criticism and historical criticism combined. Or was Mark written by somebody who was wealthy? Or was Mark written by, was Mark just a series of notes that somebody wrote up? Because it was very common to just like write notes on something and share it and then have somebody else or you yourself later publish it. And so the idea is that Mark was sort of like the first gospel which was written around 70 CE. This is
Mark, that's supposed to be Paul's cousin
That's not who Mark is.
That's a different Mark.
We don't know who Mark was. If you hear it's John Mark, we don't know. That's just tradition. So the theory of the Christian Testament, if I say New Testament, please correct me. I will probably slip.
It's hard to unlearn things that we've got spent, you know, like the beginning part of our life, and then probably like 18 to 20 years learning mm-hmm. one thing.
Right.
And all those foundational.
Yes.
Foundational years.
They really, it takes a long time to figure it out and unlearn those things.
We don't have that brain plasticity anymore that made us so good to mold and indoctrinate.
Right. So the theory, as far as is generally accepted at this point in time, in 100 years, we'll probably have a different idea. So Mark probably had Paul as a resource, Paul's letters as a resource, because it was written in 70 CE. Or around 70 CE. Probably, for those who don't know, the Jerusalem temple was destroyed in 70 CE because some Jewish people revolted and the Romans came in and destroyed the Jerusalem temple. And that's why there isn't one currently, among many other reasons. And so Mark probably knew about this. And so whenever Mark writes something like, Jesus said, I will destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, everybody who read Mark at first would actually think about the temple being destroyed. This isn't necessarily understood as foreknowledge by the original audience. They knew what was happening. And they knew that reference as much as we do. Probably more, because some people lived through it. Mark also, there's this theoretical document that was a collection of sayings called Q, and we don't know if it existed or not. It's a theorized thing. Some people accept it, some people don't. It's just something to know. And then from there, Matthew took Mark, or the author of Matthew, I'll just refer to it by the gospel name. Again, the only person that we're pretty sure about is like Luke. Matthew.
Wait, we don't know about John?
No, John is, well, we don't know about John, but it's pretty much like, okay, it was probably, the disciple whom Jesus loved is probably John.
Okay.
Like
I thought we just, don't know that.
Yeah.
I thought that was just John was a disciple whom Jesus loved.
Yeah.
And we always glossed over that.
Right. But yes, because there's some tendencies that you can read into that.
You can't see this because this is an audio medium, but I'm making a lot of faces into the camera.
Yes. So Luke probably used Mark and maybe used Matthew a little bit. And so whenever Luke writes, like, I am trying to gather a collection better than other people's in his preface, he's probably referencing Mark and saying, I'm going to do a better job than Mark. So this is text criticism, historical criticism, form criticism is a little different. And then redaction criticism is looking at how the text has changed over time. And I don't much pay attention to text criticism or redaction criticism, except to be like, hey, we know this. Okay, let's go. And again, a lot of it is working with theory because we do have thousands of documents. And this is more for the Christian Testament because we have so many more documents from that time period. So anyway, that's that stuff. Another term is the Septuagint, which technically only refers to the first five books, but colloquially we use it to refer to the entire Bible, Hebrew Bible as translated into Greek.
So the first five books of the Hebrew Torah. Bible, the Torah. Yeah. Okay. I thought that was, what's the fancy word for that? I thought that was the
Pentateuch.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. No. Okay. So the Septuagint is usually used for the Pentateuch.
Supposedly 70 or 72, depending on which myth you're reading or which source you're reading. Says that these 70 or 72 Jewish scholars translated it into Greek, and it was all the same the entire time. Jokes on them, there are like five different versions of it or whatever. And we have access to two of them at least. There's the Old Greek and then Septuagint Greek. There are even differences within Old Greek, but this is sort of like, there was a great multitude, and there, from what we have as the Masoretic text, there are a lot of additions to a lot of the books. So like Esther has six large portions that are just not in the Hebrew text.
Is that like where the rest of the book of Esther comes from?
If you're looking in the NRSV or some other books, it'll have like additions to Esther. Yeah, that's where that comes from. That's
in the book. Remember, what is the fancy word for that? It's the non-canonical books.
The deuterocanonical? Deuterocanonical?
No, it's simpler. Apocryphal? It's simpler. It's like the Apocrypha, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I remember in Bible class in high school, the teacher made a typo, and so he made us read the rest of the books of Esther, mm-hmm. and nobody had that except for me, who comes out like, oh yeah, I have an apocryphal Bible. did the reading.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I didn't, but like, I was like, I can do the reading because I have the Apocrypha.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read a different book though.
A little known thing among Protestants is that the reason that those are deuterocanonical or apocryphal books that include like Tobit, Judith, these other things.
The James and the Dragon. No, that's James and the Giant Peach. It's Daniel Bell and the Dragon.
Bell and the Dragon. That's, yeah. So that's all in the Catholic canon. Jerome from the Latin Vulgate is the reason that they're separated. So anyways, that's that. And then there's the Targum and the Talmud, which are both Aramaic. They're Jewish texts. And, you know, we have to read them. I have to read them for my research and for my own stuff, just because if I'm only reading the translation from the Masoretic text, I can't do the Septuagint.
Yeah.
And so this is the Aramaic translation, and they have additional things as well. So, limitations of this discussion, which, of course, I have to say. Number one, we cannot discuss exact dates because we don't know, especially for the Hebrew Bible. Second, we can only discuss generalities. We're not getting into the weeds. I say that. It sounds like we're getting into the weeds. Trust me, I don't know how deep the weeds go. And also, it's super boring.
I think it's interesting.
I think it's interesting too. But if we were to go much deeper than this, you would get bored much faster than I would, and I'd get bored pretty fast.
All right.
So now we're to the point of like the actual history of the Bible as we.
I thought that was still part of the history. Oh man, this is all just backstory.
Yeah, this is just general information.
There's so much I don't know, and it's like we spend our entire like first 18 years of our lives learning about this, but without learning any context.
Yes. Well, that's why I wanted to get a PhD in this stuff. Well,
and then we were like, you're taking the Bible out of context. When we're like, we don't even know the context.
Right.
We're taking it out of the context that I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So most of the information I share is going to be like text critical, historical critical, redaction critical, form critical work. And like just in general, just accept that. This is the best way we know how to understand when stuff was dated, how stuff has changed.
This is where the research is, like the biblical theological research is. This is the most up-to-date stuff we know. Gotcha. Right.
And there's this thing called the Wellhausen hypothesis. I'll get into that later, but it's sort of in the mid to late 1800s. Building off of other people's work, of course. Wellhausen, I don't remember his first name. German scholars were and still are very into text critical, historical critical stuff. And so he came up with this theory, which is broadly accepted as a general idea, but in terms of like specifics, rejected. And it was for the Torah specifically, there were four different sources. We now have multiple different sources, multiple different changes that we talk about, but this is what you're taught as like an intro level student. And so some of the stuff is rooted in that. So, and also he was also very anti-Semitic. So that's his own thing to deal with. And it shows in his work, he's open about it in his work. So we have the first really idea we have about where the Torah and the Bible as we know it comes from is Josiah and Deuteronomy. And this happened around 641 to 609 BCE. And in the Bible, we read that priests discovered the Book of the Law. This was the Book of the Law. It was probably what we would call Proto-Deuteronomy. And we think it's Proto-Deuteronomy because what happens in, I believe it's 2 Kings, Josiah enacts certain changes, and we find those changes that Josiah enacts specifically from Deuteronomy, not really in the other books of the Torah. And so in theory, we have this probably smaller book that he found that was Deuteronomy or Proto-Deuteronomy. And so in all likelihood, he expanded it and maybe expanded the entire Torah. Not whole cloth, didn't write it all whole cloth, but brought together other documents and other stories and like paid for it to be like collected, right? And of course, whenever you have all of these different things, and this is still the proto-Torah, not the actual Torah as we know it. And so after like collecting all these things, you're piecing them together.
Yeah.
They're different documents. So, some of them, very old probably. From Moses, sure, maybe not all of it, but we had these people that were like sewing these things together a little bit. So this is first idea. And if I talk about Deuteronomistic history, that's sort of connected to this Deuteronomist group theorized by Wellhausen, which again, much more complicated than that. Based on these groups, we have all connected, or this set of documents that I'm going to list is all connected to reforms and laws as listed in Deuteronomy. And so there's Joshua, Judges,
Ruth.
Nope.
Not Ruth
is its own thing. And then 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. This is.
But not 1 and 2 Chronicles.
No. 1 and 2 Chronicles is a separate history from 1 and 2 Kings written by a different person.
So they're all out of order. So it's like Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, versus 2 Samuel, 1 2 Kings.
Yes.
Why is Ruth in the middle?
That's a Christian thing. It's not a Jewish thing. We have different orders for the books.
Why?
Because Ruth takes place in the time of Judges. And so if you are laying it all out as this happened
so historically. So it's a chronological. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So even the way that we order the Bible is theologically oriented rather than like how it was historically set up. Okay. So other texts, just about everything else, including 1 and 2 Kings, right? Because that goes until the end of that ends in exile, right? And so that part, and probably Joshua, Judges, and 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, just think of those as all like one group of texts. But okay. Joshua and Judges were also written probably later, but rooted in this Deuteronomy text. A little bit. Again, this is theory largely like changed. This is just very like glossing over it. And so the exile started in around 597 to 596 BCE. Remember, dates count down.
Yeah.
About 50 years after Josiah is whenever the exile starts. Persians conquer Babylon in 539 BCE, which is about 60 years later. And remember, in the exile, the wealthy people or the powerful people are moved over and changed. It wasn't everybody. Not all the Judeans, not Jews at this point, Judeans were, or Judahites is better actually. Yeah. Judea is later. So Judahites, only like the rich and powerful people were actually taken to Babylon, because you still need people to work the land, and the people, the regular common people, like they don't pose a danger to you.
Yeah.
And so over the next few centuries, really the rest of the Hebrew Bible was written. The book of Isaiah itself, we have found the Isaiah scroll next to the Hezekiah scroll. So Hezekiah and Isaiah, we know for sure existed, or as for sure as we can possibly know. And the Isaiah, this is just an example of how stuff was written.
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah, like 1 through something, I don't remember the exact dates or the exact chapters. But like the first large section of Isaiah was written supposedly, I'm going to say probably, by Isaiah or by Isaiah's scribe.
Okay.
And so this is all talking about like doom of Judah and like Israel was already conquered. And so like we need to look out, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it turns into, at a certain point, like, God is going to return. God is going to give it back. It's a very sudden shift. And so this is probably written during exile. Different person, because this is, I don't know, some 100, I guess, some like 60, 70 years. So maybe, let's say, it's Isaiah's disciple. Or Isaiah, somebody that Isaiah taught. Just continuing Isaiah's tradition, so it's the Isaiah tradition.
Okay.
People will argue with me about this. I'm just laying it out as like, this is a theory, but we do know that it's like separate. It's not written. It's the text is written differently. Different words are used.
Okay.
And then there's a certain point even further down in Isaiah where it turns bad again, because this is after exile, and let's call them Judeans now, are like turning back away from God or whatever. And so this is another warning. So there are these three Isaiahs. Some people argue there are only two. And then there's what some people call 4th Isaiah, which who knows whether or not exists, but like the person that like sort of brought all of these texts together and sort of like wrote connections between them.
Okay. So when we think of Isaiah, like the prophet Isaiah, we're like, he wrote this entire book.
Right. No. Think of it like the Isaiah school.
Yeah.
No. Again,
like one of those book series where it's like it's the same book series, but like each book is written by a different author.
Yeah.
Okay.
So again, this isn't like a full scholarly layout of it. This is just like general ideas for people to think about. And also like the current way that to discuss it with people that aren't
all stuff that is new to me.
Yeah. So books like Daniel and Esther and Kohelet/Ecclesiastes.
Kohelet.
Yes. It's you'll know it as Ecclesiastes.
Okay.
I just go with for that book. I just go with the Hebrew term. These books were written after exile, and we know they were in exile. So Daniel, like the last half of Daniel, is written in Aramaic. I don't know how to translate the last half of Daniel yet. Esther has a lot of words that are called Persian loan words. Which means they took these words from Persia, right? So
yeah.
We know, and whenever Persia took over Babylon, so that's sort of when the exile ended, right?
Yeah.
So if you're using Persian words, it has to be after the exile, right?
Yeah, because that's when you got introduced to the Persian language.
Yeah. And so Kohelet/Ecclesiastes as well uses Aramaic and uses Persian words. One of the Persian words is Medina, which means province.
Medina.
And so it's just a Persian word.
Okay.
Ecclesiastes uses Persian or uses Aramaic idioms that, or even certain words that don't even make sense if you're translating it from the Hebrew. But if you look at what it would look like in Aramaic, it's like, oh, this is used all the time in Aramaic texts.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right. And so it's these influences are coming in. During the Persian period, they start rebuilding the temple. This is what we call the Second Temple period, starting around 537 BCE, ending 70 CE, because that's whenever the temple
was destroyed. Yeah.
And please stop me if you have any questions or comments or jokes.
Mostly, I'm just like, oh my gosh, like all this processing information. If I have a joke, I'll let you know. Don't worry.
Got it.
No jokes right now.
So interesting side notes about the Second Temple period. There was already a Second Temple built before that one.
So there's the whole book of the Bible where it's like the dude.
Ezra and Nehemiah.
I was just like, I don't know. My mom made us read it. Mm-hmm. But like he goes back and he builds the temple and he does leadership stuff. So there is already a temple.
Not there. Not in Israel. Not in Judah or Judea, I guess is the correct term now.
Was it the Samaritan temple?
It was not the Samaritan temple.
No, the Samaritan temple.
It was.
But there was the Egyptian temple. The Egyptian temple.
Yes. Yeah, in around the 6th century.
Wait, that's where they took the Ark of the Covenant.
No. That's just theory. Like that's just the Babylonian.
Oh, that's
the
drugs.
Yeah.
I was like, it's something to do there.
George Lucas does not know much about the Bible. So in around the 6th
century. You got it right that if you touch it, you die.
That's fair.
That's biblical.
Yeah. So in the 6th century, which is, you know, around the time that the other before the Jerusalem Second Temple was built. There was in Elephantine, a very large Jewish population that built a temple. And it was destroyed in 410 BCE, rebuilt, but after a few years just abandoned. Probably because there was another temple in Jerusalem as well, where the old one used to be. And also, like, you know, you move. You don't live in Elephantine anymore. Elephantine was an island somewhere in the Nile. So, you know, you leave, you move. Whatever.
What was there? Did we find it?
Yeah, we know about it. It's super, like, yeah.
How come we never heard of this temple?
Because it's not, like, considered important, largely.
Okay.
But like, there was this huge Jewish community in Egypt that's very important.
I thought they all left.
No, like, well, they did originally, but, like, whenever your place gets taken over by Babylon and Assyria and all this stuff, I think it's, I can't remember which prophet. I want to say Jeremiah. It's Jeremiah or Ezekiel or one of those. They actually talk about fleeing to Egypt. And one of them.
I thought that was Mary and Joseph because the worm dude was king.
No. also okay. That's Herod. But no, like Jews fled to Egypt, and Jeremiah or Ezekiel or one of those other prophets, again, can't remember exactly, went with them.
Oh.
And there are additions to, I'm going to say Jeremiah from here on out. Please forgive me if I'm wrong. Jeremiah, like, there are additions to Jeremiah where Jeremiah gets, like, taken to, like, whatever and sees Habakkuk and, like, sees Daniel or whatever. But so Jeremiah, again, sorry if I'm wrong, goes to Egypt with people. And some other prophets say, like, don't go to Egypt because trust God instead. So there's this internal complication there as well. Now we get to the Samaritans. So probably around the time of exile, you know, some words and some ideas of Torah or whatever were really brought from the northern kingdom of Israel. And there's like the language there is a bit different. And it's just that the Samaritans were probably loyal Jews who, whenever the Torah was sort of like brought together or whatever, had the same thing, but their version said Mount Gerizim was the best mountain, was the good mountain.
Mm-hmm.
That was whatever. The idea is Mount Gerizim was the place of the tabernacle rather than Shiloh. Yeah. And so I don't know if you remember anything about Shiloh. That's like Eli in 1 Samuel is at Shiloh. So it's because in the non-Samaritan Jewish Torah, it's Shiloh's one of the big places. And so Mount Gerizim is where the Samaritan Pentateuch has the tabernacle being. And here's the weird thing. Our version of Joshua says Mount Gerizim is where the thing is where the tabernacle is.
So our Bible says that it's both in Shiloh and in Mount Gerizim.
Yes.
Okay.
So some people will argue, again, not part of this conversation for me, that the Samaritan Pentateuch is actually the oldest version.
So do we, the Hebrew Bible, does it say in Joshua that it's at Shiloh or Mount Gerizim? Or
it's weird, complicated. It's only mentioned like twice in Joshua. But when Joshua is reads toward Mount Gerizim being the good mountain.
Okay.
It's much more complicated than what I'm saying. But
I was just wondering if we had like a patchwork, like we took the Samaritan book of Joshua and the Hebrew Pentateuch and then just kind of stitched them together and then.
No, okay. It's just Joshua was used by the non-Samaritan Jews. So, you know, we don't know which one's the oldest version, but our own Bible seems to disagree with itself a little bit.
Okay.
Even the English translation. Next piece of history that you're going to want to know is that the Persians funded the temple, right? We know this.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they funded the documenting of people's different histories.
Hmm.
They paid for scribes to write up the history of their people. This is where we're going to start talking about big texts, important texts like this sort of thing. Like, the Persian Empire paid for it. We don't have any documents saying that they specifically paid for the Judean historical documents to be written and collected.
Mm-hmm.
Collected and written. What we do have is them doing it to a bunch of other people. So we can assume, in general, they probably did.
Was there a political agenda in writing it?
They specifically wrote it, had people write it in a way that made it so the Persian Empire taking them over
was a good thing. Gotcha. Okay.
Right?
Okay. And so it's rewriting the history and oppression of peoples.
Right.
Okay. Well, I am. American history is very familiar with that.
Yeah. So maybe this is part, like, they probably paid for the books of Ezra and Nehemiah to be written.
Okay.
Hard to deal with it. What does it mean that, like, you had documents that you used? Or like ancient people had documents that they used, and you know, the Persian Empire might have come in and forced them to write it a certain way, and maybe that's the text that we have, and maybe it's not. Maybe the Persian Empire forced them to change the actual history. We don't know.
This book has been sponsored by Cyrus the Great,
exactly.
King of Persia, greatest person in the land.
Although I imagine it was probably Darius.
Oh, man. I just typed in Persian king during the Bible because I can't remember.
Yeah.
There. King Darius? Like, yeah. I am King Darius.
From VeggieTales? For sure.
I've had a dream. Yeah. Boom. Something, 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 mm-hmm. something. Tell me what it means.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
That guy.
Archibald Asparagus.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, you know, this is just something they did. This is also, as far as we are able to tell, probably the same time period that the Torah, as we have it, was written. Collected, not like written whole cloth, but like brought together in the shape of five books.
Okay.
Before it, it wasn't a collection of five books all on one scroll. So yeah, and this is also probably where we get the Deuteronomistic history, right? Because if you're writing if the Persian Empire, even if they don't care if you're writing it in favor of them, they want you to write down your history. And so this is probably where we get Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd King, and maybe 1st and 2nd Chronicles.
Now we're including them. Okay. They weren't included before, but now they are.
Well, again, 1st and 2nd Chronicles and 1st and 2nd Kings sort of have different ideas. Yeah. Like 1st and 2nd Chronicles has Manasseh turning to God at the end of his life, and 1st and 2nd Kings does not.
Oh.
Right. And so you have to ask yourself, oh, King Manasseh. Yeah, I don't remember which verses exactly.
Wait, Manasseh.
King Manasseh. Not the tribe. King Manasseh.
Is he the brother of Absalom?
No.
No.
I want to say he's like Josiah's son or Josiah's father.
Right, because Josiah was the good guy, and then Josiah was like the one good king.
Yeah. Well, there were many good kings. But
he was like the good king that God liked.
Right. And so in 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Manasseh is read, again, I might have these switched, but I think it's 1st and 2nd Chronicles, has it read that God does not destroy Judah because Manasseh turns to God, and 1st and 2nd Kings does not have that part.
Interesting.
Yeah. So again, these are different people writing differently. I'm not saying either of them is wrong or right. I'm just saying it's different.
Agendas of the author, perhaps.
Right. Yeah. We also have, at this time period of Persia, Alexander the Great comes through and defeats them. Mm-hmm. And whenever he dies, after a series of wars, his empire splits into four different groups. And the two empires that are most important here are the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And so the Seleucids were sort of like to the north, where Persia, Babylon, that group is.
Yeah. And
the Ptolemies are like Egypt, and they fought over Palestine.
Okay.
Palestine being the large version, Judea being just like a small section that was part of Palestine. Or Syria-Palestine, you might say.
Okay.
And so they fought over it because, you know, it's the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. You want that.
Yeah.
Just for military purposes and everything. And so here, this started around 332 BCE and ends about 167 BCE. And that's whenever Rome starts taking over. And so the Ptolemies were largely better. They treated the Judeans better. The Seleucids, we'll get to there. The Seleucids are the reason the Maccabees happened. So another important part is the Zadokite priesthood, or the Zadokite priesthood. Can you tell me what that sounds like?
Zadokite?
Or Zadok.
Zadokite. Oh, it sounds like Sadducees. Sadducees.
There you go. So, it's called the Zadokite priesthood because they were, from the time of David, they were the Levitical priests in charge of the temple, in charge of Judah. They were loyal to the king. This is because the priesthood was taken away from Eli's sons, right? You remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they were like drunk people and just like did bad sins and they stole stuff.
Yeah, and they gave strange fire, and I think they brought prostitutes into the Holy of Holies.
Yeah, that's what it was.
The Zadokites from Zadok, the actual, like a person that you can read about in the Bible, helped David out. And so he was the replacement for that set of priests.
I thought Samuel was the replacement.
Who?
Samuel.
No.
I thought Samuel taught from Eli.
Yeah, but he wasn't like it was. He also had very bad sons.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and I don't know if he was ever named high priest or if he was just there. But okay. Zadok takes over from David, and Samuel's already dead.
Okay, I feel like I would have remembered the name Zadok because it sounds kind of cool. It starts with a Z.
Yeah, Ezra and Ezra Nehemiah is. By the way, Ezra Nehemiah is the same. It's one scroll, so it's just called Ezra Nehemiah.
Okay. So why we have it two books? Because we wanted just an Ezra and a Nehemiah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like even in my translation, like my, or not my translation, my actual like Hebrew text, it's Ezra Nehemiah.
Ezra Nehemiah, okay. Yeah.
So Ezra is a Zadokite priest. During the period of the four empires, there's actually a name for it. I'm not going to look it up. But just four empires that are all ruling at the same time.
Okay.
The Seleucids and the Ptolemies being the most important for our discussion.
Okay.
During this time, the priests would make deals with the Seleucid and Ptolemaic emperors to become high priests. So siblings would say, this one sibling under the rule of the Ptolemies would say, "Hey Ptolemies, we're having a good time. I'm your high priest. I'm giving you all the taxes because we don't have a king. So the priests were in charge of everything. They were the bureaucracy."
Okay.
So the priests were like, "Hey, this brother, there are actual names. I'm not going to get into them." This one high priest is like, "We're going along great, Ptolemies." And his brother is like, "I want to be high priest. Hey, Seleucids, if you come take control over us, I'll give you more money." And so they would kill each other. They would make deals with other empires. Gosh. Very corrupt priesthood to an extent.
Yeah.
And really the Ptolemies, again, in as much as you enslave people and force them to pay taxes and like put them into a state of starvation, they were better than the Seleucids. Lesser of two evils. Really, they only cared about the taxes, and they helped fund different building projects. And the Seleucids tried harder to turn the Judeans, from this point forward, I'll call them Jews, because we're around that history where they start separating into Jews. Trying to get the Jews to become more like the Greeks.
Okay.
So again.
Hellenization, right? Like we've learned that in school. Okay.
Yeah.
Also, it's not coming up on the timeline.
Yeah. So the Ptolemies were totally okay with people being different throughout their empire. In fact, the Ptolemaic emperor Ptolemy himself, the actual first Ptolemy that ruled, actually went and like had himself called Pharaoh and went through all the things. All the like cultural steps that the Egyptians had their pharaohs go through, and claimed to be the son of Ra, I think it was.
Ra's the sun god.
Ra or Horus or.
Horus is that Ibis god.
Yes.
I think most of the pharaohs were sons of Ra.
I think it was actually Horus.
Horus.
Or his son, or maybe Osiris. No, Osiris was the father. Horus was
Osiris the son. Is the god of the dead.
Yeah. So Osiris gave birth. Osiris's son is Horus, and so the pharaohs were sons of Horus.
I thought the pharaohs were sons of Ra.
No, they were sons of Horus because Horus was largely like there were different Egyptian periods, and so they probably claimed different things. But Horus was the big god that ruled all of Egypt.
I was thinking of who's the Ibis god.
The what?
Ibis headache.
Oh, I don't know.
I was thinking of Thoth.
Thoth, yeah. Okay, no worries. So here we get, under the rule of the Ptolemies, we know, were funding the Library of Alexandria and were collecting a whole bunch of documents from the people under their control. And so this is how we get the letter of Aristeus and the Septuagint, is it's the translation into Greek. And there were other texts translated into Greek from Hebrew and Aramaic and Egyptian and a whole bunch of other languages, just being collected in the Library of Alexandria.
That still hurts, knowing what happens to that.
So I want to be clear about Library of Alexandria, is it was burned four different times by four different people, and oftentimes it is blamed on Muslims, but Christians burned the Library of Alexandria too, and other groups did too. It was just as being a huge cultural monument with lots of knowledge, people who didn't like that knowledge. In fact, the Muslim people actually saved. They're largely the reason that we have so many like Greek philosophy texts. They saved it whenever Christians were destroying it.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm pretty sure, you know, Christians, they did a lot of fun stuff of like, you know, we're going to go save the Holy Land, i.e. let's go sack Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Crusaders. That was our school team name.
Right. So just to be clear, this just happened. To give you specific texts that are very different between the Hebrew and the Septuagint as we have them, also known as the received text or Textus Receptus.
Okay.
You have Exodus, 1 and 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel is known as a highly corrupted text, which means like we're very sure that the version of 2 Samuel that we have now is not what it originally was.
And no one tells us this.
Right. Well, they don't know.
But we're pretty sure.
We're pretty sure. But to get it from the universities to the churches, people don't want to hear that 2 Samuel is probably not what it originally was. And somebody came in and messed with it. And we know this from like Qumran and the Septuagint and the Aramaic and like all these different things. So anyway.
But we don't want to even bring up the possibility that part of the Bible's wrong, because then that's the, you know, we start picking out one thread, then the whole thing becomes unraveled. And then how are we supposed to control people and get their tithe money?
Yeah. And also like you can get fired as a minister if you know this and share it and people don't like it. Yeah.
Fired for this?
Oh, for sure. People have been fired for this.
For being truthful and telling the truth and being, well, not the truth, but like saying, hey, we don't know all this stuff. This is where the research is.
Yep. People get fired.
Oh my gosh.
So other texts that are very changed, Jeremiah, Esther, and Daniel. And that's the list I came up with. Everything else, there are differences, but mostly minor, which on the other hand means they're probably decent translations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, probably quite a while. So here we get in 167 BCE to the Maccabean revolt / Hasmonean dynasty. And the Hasmoneans were another group of priests. There's the Zadokites, and there are many priestly families, and the Maccabeans were one of them. And, or not the Maccabeans, the Hasmoneans were one of them. And Judas Maccabeus was one of the big ones. So you know how I mentioned that the Seleucid Empire was not very good or nice.
Yeah.
There were some problems happening, and Antiochus the Fourth, Seleucus Antiochus the Fourth, erected a statue of Zeus in the Jerusalem temple. And the Jews.
Zeus,
yeah.
Like the Greek god Zeus, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Jews said no, and they fought back. This is where Judas Maccabeus enters the picture. This
the Maccabees.
Yeah. So you have the Zadokites, who are like making deals and like fighting each other or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the Maccabees, who are like, no, you erected Zeus in the middle of this, in the middle of our temple. We're going to fight back. You want to read about it? There are 4 books of Maccabees.
Those are in the Apocrypha.
I think you'll probably only find 1 and 2 Maccabees.
I think there's only 2 Maccabees in the Apocrypha, because I don't remember 4 Maccabees.
Yeah, 3 and 4 Maccabees aren't really accepted as much. So the whole history there, the Hasmoneans become the new priest kings. They replaced Zadokites. Again, the Sadducees. Eventually, maybe.
And Hasmoneans is the Pharisees.
No.
No.
They're just their own group.
Okay.
So and the Zadokites continue to exist. They're just no longer the rulers, the bureaucracy in charge.
That's why they're so sad, you see. Sad. Because they're not
very bad.
It was terrible.
That's very bad.
I know. That's how I remember, because of the song. Don't want me a Sadducee because they're so Sadducee.
Mm-hmm. I should also add, now that you're saying that the Sadducees / Zadokites were super into Hellenization. They were like, let's build gymnasiums. Let's get connected. They were the upper class to an extent. So they were very into like Greek culture.
Yeah.
Which is part of the reason why whenever the Hasmoneans took over, they said like, you're going to play second fiddle from here on out. We're in charge now.
Yeah.
The Hasmoneans surprise, surprise, occasionally fought for power and made deal with other empires.
It's like people in power are corrupted and just want money and power.
Yeah. Huh. Like that. One of the cool things, though, is they made deals with Rome. And that is one of the ways that they made sure that the Seleucid and Ptolemaic empires did not try to take control of them. Is they're like, we have Rome on our side. And so, you know, Rome takes over in 63 BCE. You can make as many deals as you want, but eventually Rome's going to be at your door and they're going to be like, we're done making deals.
Yeah.
We want control of everything. Bunch of stuff happens. Texts continue being shared.
Hey, this is Josh Turpin. We're splitting up this episode into a few different episodes, so please bear with us. My co-host is Abigail Williams. Thank you for listening. We're so grateful to you for listening. If you have any comments, any suggestions, please write to us at podcast@unlearningchildhood.com. If you have any corrections, let us know. I think that's about it. Oh, thank you to Kai Jorgensen for the use of his song Coffee and Cigarettes. And thank you to Dear or Dear Bits on Twitter for the creation of our thumbnail. It's excellent work. All right. Hope everyone has a great day.